We want to get to know you as well. This wonderful accent that you have, tell us about it.
Okay, well, it comes, I guess, originally from Russia, from Siberia.
But you call yourself a Russian-born New Zealander.
I do, because I am. I was born in Russia, and my family just found themselves, I guess, in New Zealand by chance. We ended up living in New Zealand, and this is where I learned my English. I was 19 when I went to New Zealand without a word of English apart from hello and how are you.
Amazing.
And I guess my accent, some people hear a little bit of a New Zealand accent, a lot of people hear a lot of Russian, Eastern European, and of course now I haven't been here for over 10 years in Britain. Hopefully I have picked up some British accents as well.
I think we'll let our listeners decide on that. We'll come to Leeds, but explain to me first of all, I mean, it's just a world, it's literally a world away from what we understand. Growing up in Siberia, it's such a strange question because it's a massive one, but tell me about growing up.
Okay, well, I grew up on a collective farm, so something that was in place during the communist regime. I grew up with my grandmother, who was a school teacher, and my parents were both musicians. So they were students at a conservatory in Omsk, and they couldn't look after me until I was 5 years old. So I spent my first years with my grandmother, who taught me all kinds of subjects, writing and reading and mathematics. Unfortunately, I'm really, really bad at mathematics. She didn't do her job so well there. But I loved writing. I remember absolutely loving writing and reading. And I wanted to become a writer when I grew up. And I have become one, I guess.
You certainly have. We're going to come to the fact that you managed to write a book in 6 months, which sickens me, frankly. but the impetus wasn't music necessarily. It was writing for you when you were younger.
When I was young, the impetus was very much on music, actually. As soon as I moved in with my parents, because they were both students, they practiced day and night. They played a Russian instrument called domra. So it's a folk Russian instrument, which is related somewhat to a mandolin. And it's sort of looks like a ladle or like a round balalaika, and it has three strings, and it's incredibly virtuosic and incredibly difficult instrument to pick up. And so I was listening to my father and my mother practicing, taking turns, and I do not remember a day of my life without music.
Wow, what a day of your life without music, that's incredible.
In the home environment. And of course, my parents were students. They had to go to the conservatoire, and I was left at home alone quite a lot. You know, it was quite okay in those days, I guess, where I come from. And I remember that I spent quite a lot of time teaching myself to play the piano from teach yourself piano book. And when I went to the music school, I already could read music and play. So my teacher.
So this was, how old were you when you
I went was to? 9 when I went to the music school. When I was 7, my parents asked me, do you want to go and study music? And I said, no, I don't. So they kind of didn't push me. And 2 years later, I decided that I don't even remember the process. I remember it was just so natural. It wasn't a thought, it was just a feeling. And I came up to them and I said, yes, I think now I want to go and study music. And that's how I ended up in the music school in
at
Russia.
9, that's an extraordinary thing to decide to do at the age of 9. And you must have known what it meant because, well, as you say, you went to the music school. The conservatoire over there is quite different to what we might imagine. How hard was it?
Oh, it was really intense. I guess it was, yes, it was hard from the point of intensity, from the point of there being so few holidays. As students, we didn't really have any time off. I was required to practice at least 8 hours a day on the piano. And that is on top of all the other subjects that I had to do. And that included philosophy and I think Italian language and...
You speak Italian?
I don't speak Italian because I took it only for a month and then I actually immigrated to New Zealand.
You're at the conservatoire, you're playing 8 hours a day, and you made that decision at 9 years old. And then what happened when you went to New Zealand, and how did you end up there?
My father was a musician, as I said, and after the breakup of the USSR, suddenly there were loads of orchestras appeared that took Russian folk music to the world outside or beyond the confines of the USSR, former USSR. So my father was invited to join one of such orchestras and to go on a six-month tour of Australia. He went, of course, and he said to us before he left that he will try and stay there if he could. He could speak English at that time, and I think that was 1993. And he studied English during the Soviet times. And I remember people asking him quite often, why are you doing this?
People were confused. They didn't
understand.
People
were confused. Why would he study a language that he would never have a hope of using in England or anywhere else? And he always told me that he had a feeling that he will need that language one day, and that's why he persevered. So he found himself in Australia and made a lot of friends there. And
that must have been such a change of lifestyle for you. It must have been hard for you to almost get your head around, I imagine.
What was hard for me is that I haven't seen him for a year and a half whilst he was on tour. Mm. And that was difficult because, as you know, I was 17 at that point, and I was dreaming about, you know, a Soviet girl from a Siberian collective farm, thinking my father is in Australia. He must be living in grand palaces and enjoying this amazing lifestyle. And when I actually did join him in New Zealand, because that's where he ended up, it certainly wasn't like that to begin with.
Well, he got up. It's an amazing story about your dad when he first got to New Zealand. He started walking.
Yes. Well, actually, on the last day of his Australian tour, he needed either to go back to Russia or do something. And he received a letter from New Zealand on that last day and inviting him for 3 years to work with a mandolin orchestra. And of course, he hopped on the plane on that last day, literally, and went to New Zealand. He knew nothing about the people he was going to work with or the city he was going to live in, which was Auckland. And he got off the plane and started walking towards the city centre, saw a building site, and mentioned to the builders there, would they mind giving him some work, because he learned some plastering skills whilst in Australia, and they told him to come back the next day. He did, and they've accepted him, so he was able to earn a little bit of money before he could start working with the orchestra.
And you, how did you end up over there? Because the whole, well, you and your family went over there.
Yes, well, I ended up there because his visa was for 3 years. We were able to join him, and when I say we, I mean my mother and my sister. So we went to New Zealand a year and a half after our father left Russia. So we were all reunited in Auckland. In New Zealand, I felt extremely relaxed for the first 5 years. I got into my head that I will never, ever study again because I was so exhausted from 8 hours of practice every day for 10 years or however long that was. And that lasted for 5 years. 2 years after I got to New Zealand, my father died, and that made me rethink everything. I suddenly looked at myself and realized that I was teaching piano, you know, I had private pupils, and I didn't feel like my life was going anywhere. So I decided to go back to the university, and that's where I discovered writing and researching and realized that I actually really love doing that. And I did a postgraduate degree in New Zealand, and then I decided that I had to do a PhD, and that's how I ended up in Leeds.
That makes no sense, but we'll get to the bottom of that, don't worry. It's the interesting thing, and obviously clearly it's a sad thing, you were only 19 when your father died, but it sounds like it was a real moment for you. You kind of made a decision and you changed your life, because it's one thing to go from, I mean, it's extraordinary that you were teaching piano lessons privately and then you end up here, and was it just a moment where you said, right, I now have to do the thing that I need to do?
Yes, it was a very brief moment, I guess, or a realization or a feeling that I had to do something. I just felt that I wasn't using my brain correctly in the way I wanted to do. And for me, going back to the university was a very natural step. And I'm actually so glad that I did have those 5 years out, because I didn't do it, I didn't progress after undergrad to postgrad without thinking about it.
You had a plan and you knew what you were doing.
Yes.
I want to understand how on earth, because you speak beautifully about coming to Leeds and how you felt, but I want to understand how you ended up here. When you came to Leeds, something clicked for you. You stepped off the train and it felt like home for you.
Yes, I felt literally really very much at home, and I didn't bother checking any other universities that I lined up for myself. I went to the University of Leeds and met with my prospective PhD supervisor there at that time, and I just decided that this is where I had to live, and so I did.
We'll go back to how you ended up here, but why was that? That's an amazing visceral reaction to a city.
It was just a feeling. I spent 2 years prior in West Sussex in a small village with absolutely beautiful surroundings. And I lived in London for a bit. But I don't know, I just never felt like this anywhere else prior to coming to Leeds. I have felt since, but I just loved it.
Oh, it's lovely to hear that you enjoyed it so much. But how did you actually end up here? So you're studying in New Zealand and then you make the decision.
Yes, I did a postgraduate dissertation in a Russian composer called Kalinnikov and his symphonic works. And my supervisor and I thought that I should probably keep going with my research into Russian 19th century music. But he said, well, there's no one in New Zealand who could supervise you at this stage. Why don't you go to England? So I decided that was a wonderful idea. And that's why I came here.
Do you work at Leeds College of Music? It's very important to you because you came here to study. You also, there were two very significant men in your life. One of them is Andrei Tchaikovsky. Tell me about the other one.
Oh, the other one is my husband, Daniel Johnson, whom I met in Leeds and married, obviously. he's a classically trained jazz saxophonist and composer, and I am very, very proud of the work that he produces now. He's currently working on an album with his new band that is yet to have a name. I think at the moment they're called something like World Jazz Quartet, reflecting Daniel's interests in world musics that inspire his compositions. I met Daniel in a cellar, the Cellar Bar in Leeds. It's a musical venue where he was listening to his favorite jazz band, and I was out celebrating with David Pountney and some people from Opera North the opening of the opera, The Portrait by Weinberg. And that's how we met, and as neither of us looked back.
And the reason it's clearly it was love at first sight is because you sat next to someone who you barely registered. Because who was that person?
Corinne Bailey Ray.
You just look straight past her to your husband, your future husband. I imagine the music in your house must be amazing.
Yes, it is.
Tell me about I mentioned the other man in your life, Andrei Tchaikovsky. What is it about this? Because, all right, well, let's tell the story about how you met him. When did he die?
He died 31 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So how did you meet him?
I met him in a highly unconventional way, something that not every researcher would be able to experience, if any. Andrei Tchaikovsky, when he died, donated his skull to the Royal Shakespeare Company. He was so passionate about theatre, and he loved Shakespeare. So he donated the skull, and it is still kept at the Royal Shakespeare Company. David Tennant used his skull in 2009 production of Hamlet. And as part of my research project on Tchaikovsky, I've been involved in filming the documentary on him. And so as part of the documentary, we went to film Tchaikovsky's Skull. And that was the first time when I met him. And it was the most surreal experience because having spent 6 months literally in his head reading his diaries, I now saw that same very head, but empty of those thoughts. It was just so beautiful and sad and poignant. And I am extremely privileged to have had that experience.
I could tell just the very way you wrote about it. It was an incredibly moving thing for you because it was just a skeleton, but actually you attached and you had such an experience when you were there holding his skull. Amazing.
It was hugely emotional. I still can't actually speak about it without emotion now. Yes.
It's okay, you're allowed emotion on my show. Why is it that you were so... what was it about his music and about him that seemed to obsess you so much?
Oh, his complexity and his love of life and his love of music, composition. He was a very difficult person to be around, judging from his writings and the memories of his friends. But he was an extremely fascinating person. I hope when my book comes out in English, it will become easier to read rather than my current German version.
Yeah, can you not read that version?
No, it's been translated for me. So he was just an absolutely wonderful musician, and the first track that I chose was his performance of the Bach Piano Concerto, and his music just really touches me. It's very intense, very complex, very but at the same time very, very beautiful. A very good, wonderful friend called Nir Arieli, and he always tells me that, yes, I should give myself a little bit more credit sometimes for certain things. I don't know. I don't think about giving myself credit necessarily. I just look back and look at all the things that I've done and feel incredibly lucky that I had a chance to do all of these things. To give myself credit for maybe being brave enough to follow the things through, not to take no for an answer in many cases, and to just, choose the path that I decided to follow and go for it.
It's pretty good advice. I want to ask you finally, we're going to finish with some of your dad's music. Mm-hmm. You used a phrase that I've never read before. You said your father was an incredible being.
Yes.
Why did you choose that word? Tell me a bit about your dad.
Because he was he's not a man or a person. He really was a being. He was a beautiful person, really kind, and he had a very quiet passion for music. He didn't, run around and scream about it like I do sometimes. but he just, from the very early stage in his life, followed the musical path and liked performing and composing. And the track that I chose today is actually an arrangement of a very popular song called Besame Mucho, and he arranged it for his trio that he had in New Zealand, composed of his domra, guitar and the double bass.
Dr. Anastasia Bellina Johnson, this is your dad. Thank you very much for being my one-on-one.